What was happening in Jerusalem that made Zephaniah's warning of the coming day of the Lord so urgent? Hello, I'm Alden Thompson for The Good Word. Joining me in our conversation on this new book, The 12, this is Zephaniah, John Dibdall, and Dave Thomas, also colleagues with roots in the School of Theology. Now, before we come back to that question, I'd like to give just a little bit of a background on Zephaniah. The first verse of Zephaniah says that he was in the reign of Josiah at the time when, during his ministry, Josiah was the king who initiated the great reform in 621, during which the book of the law was rediscovered in the temple. Now, some 80 years before Josiah, King Hezekiah had celebrated a great Passover in Jerusalem. But now, as described in 2 Chronicles 34, the temple had been virtually abandoned and Josiah set about a great reform, part of which involved discovering the book of the law. But note this astonishing chronology according to 2 Chronicles 34. Josiah was 8 years old when he began to reign. But he didn't begin to seek the Lord until he was 16. So what did he do during that eight-year period between 8 and 16? The Bible doesn't say. Then after taking Bible studies for 4 years, he finally decides to clean out the signs of Canaanite worship in the city. He was now 20. After 6 more years, when he would have been 26, he decided it was time to clean out the temple. And that's when they found the book of the law, probably a copy of Deuteronomy. Everyone, including the king, was horrified. Now, my question to you two men is, what in the world does this tell us about the status of true religion in the land of Judah?
Before you go there, what do you mean by even the king was horrified? They were horrified at the difference between the way they were living and what they found in the law, or they were horrified?
Apparently surprised that there was even such a thing as the law.
Oh, okay.
That's the way the text reads. John, do you read it that way too?
Yeah, I would read it that way. I would say that they probably just didn't know about it and never heard about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we're so used to having people with full libraries, you know, you can take the book, but for the king himself to be caught by surprise.
Well, do we know even if the king was literate? We have no idea whether he was literate or not. So maybe there were very few people that could have read it and they were ignored.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But certainly they didn't know its content.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, the picture that I grew up with was every year the study going down to Jerusalem for the festivals, but it was apparently much more erratic than that.
Mm-hmm. And so now your question is, what about the status of true religion in Judah?
Was it erratic instead of as nice and trim and tidy as we have sometimes been led to think?
How easily people stray. I mean, you talk about the reform that took place just 80 years before. One would think that that would have some lingering effect, but it seems to have had very little effect, at least as were revealed in Chronicles. You know,
and that's especially true in times of prosperity, that our sense of need for anything beyond ourselves, including the idea of God and religion, declines significantly in times of prosperity. So I think that the nature of true religion was probably cyclical then, as it has been through most of human history.
And when you have the level of education that most people had at that time, you're even more prone to lose it because the average person doesn't have any way to connect if they're not being taught or shown.
Now, a few weeks ago, we had the book of Joel, which talks a lot about the day of the Lord and also links it with the heavenly signs. And going way back to my college years, and J. Paul Grove brought this to my attention, it is amazing how often those heavenly signs are linked with the day of the Lord. And I would have to concur with J. Paul's assessment that the day of the Lord in the Old Testament is always an immediate day, very near, close at hand. And the signs, sun, moon, and stars, those are almost always linked with that day as well. And I'll just tick off here. For instance, the day of the Lord passages or related terms, you find them in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Zephaniah, Zechariah, Malachi. So it's a very prominent thing. And in Zephaniah, that comes really very much to the top. Now, the celestial signs, in connection with those kinds of events are found in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Joel, Amos, Habakkuk, and then moving to the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, Acts, Revelation. So we're dealing here with some very prominent stuff, and the heavenly signs are linked with the day of the Lord in many references. Now, my question is, in Matthew 24 and 25, Jesus warns us not to be focused too much on events because the coming will be a surprise. Do the passages in Zephaniah and elsewhere in the prophets make it sound like the day of the Lord is some distant event, or is it very near?
It seems very clear from the passage that it's something near.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, why would the urgency be for them to talk about it? It seems to be directly relevant, and to be relevant, it has to be near.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't see any other way to understand this, but it clearly is a repeating kind of thing. It is not a one-time issue, because you have the locusts in one place, and you have an invasion in another place, and you have various things that are talked about in connection with the day of the Lord. So it is not one event. It is an event type.
And in some contexts, in fact, the people are inclined to think of the day of the Lord, oh, this is wonderful. But many of the prophets say, not so fast. It's darkness, not light.
And so the reason for this repetition is to maintain a sense of urgency? Is that what you're suggesting?
Certainly not allowing the people to push it off a long ways away.
Mm.
I think for mature Christians today, based in the light of the New Testament, we shouldn't have to be constantly threatened. We ought to be ready at any time, and that's certainly the emphasis in Matthew 24.
That's the message,
25.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Matthew 24.
But that doesn't mean we will be.
But and you would say the same for the signs as for the statements about the day of the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. Now, it was in this context, and this is where a touch of Adventist history I find really quite intriguing, because Adventists believed that the Lord was going to come on October 22, 1844. Then they went into waiting, just as the parable of the 10 virgins suggests back in Matthew 25. But after about 40 years, Ellen White, who almost never addressed her critics directly, wrote these remarkable words: "The angels of God in their messages to men represent time as very short. Thus it has always been presented to me. It is true that time has continued longer than we expected in the early days of this message. Our Savior did not appear as soon as we had hoped. But has the word of the Lord failed? Never. It should be remembered that the promises and threatenings of God are alike conditional." And we talked about that in Jonah's day as well. And I must take advantage of the airtime here to share two of my favorite C.S. Lewis quotes. A wonderful essay of his, The World's Last Night, in which he talks about the advantage of not knowing when it's going to be. This is one, it's on page 107 in his essay. "We must never speak to simple, excitable people about the day without emphasizing again and again the utter impossibility of prediction. We must try to show them that the impossibility is an essential part of the doctrine. If you do not believe our Lord's words, why do you believe in his return at all? And if you do believe them, must you not put away from you utterly and forever any hope of dating that return? His teaching on the subject quite clearly consisted of three propositions. One, that he will certainly return. Two, that we cannot possibly find out when. Three, that, therefore, we must always be ready for him."
Yeah, it's a good quote.
And in that same essay, I think this is one of his more clever statements about the role of fear. It's a couple pages later, 109. He says, "Perfect love, we know, casteth out fear, but so do several other things: ignorance, alcohol, passion, presumption, and stupidity. It is very desirable that we should all advance to that perfection of love in which we shall fear no longer. But it is very undesirable until we have reached that stage that we should allow any inferior agent to cast out fear." So that brings us back then to the Old Testament stuff here. This all that fear-mongering and Zephaniah, boy, it's potent stuff. Well, it has some good news at the end, but it's pretty potent. How does that relate to the New Testament? Is there any difference, or are human beings still the same and still have to be clobbered with a touch of fear when they get careless?
Are you asking whether we should talk to Christians about urgency and cause a little fear?
That's one of my questions.
Well, it seems to me that it depends on the situation. There are some people who are extremely sensitive, and the idea of fear and getting scared comes very easily, and they shy away from that and are not helped by that. There are other people who need to be hit over the head by a 2x4 before they pay attention and even hear what's going on. And so I think that it depends on the situation. We have to ask the prophets, how do you assess your audience? Mm-hmm. How are you understanding your audience? And to what degree should the heat be turned up?
And I worry about this from the other end, because you can get into the wolf syndrome, where people are forever talking about, you might not get home today before Jesus comes. You might not, and it creates almost a frenzy that finally causes people to disengage.
Sure.
Yeah. I remember a student many, many years ago who was telling about how he really got onto a high with last day events and just really a frenzy. But the problem was that it was kind of like a drug addiction, he said.
Yeah.
And it always took more and more and more to get the same level. And he said he got to the place where he had absolutely no emotion, no response whatsoever, even to ordinary things like the Sabbath. It just had destroyed his life. So I think we have to be fairly careful when we look at how we use that, but it's one where we need to be sensitive.
Almost anything that we do, if we overplay it, in the end, people become tired of it and weary, and it's the same way here.
Yeah, and you can become very lax by destroying urgency completely and saying, well, it doesn't matter. And the other one is you can become frantic.
Sure, sure. So you have to find a balance there.
You know, our new staff member, Brant Berglund, reminded me of something I used to say when he was a student here before, and that's been a long time. I'd almost forgotten it. He told me the problem that I had is I shared with him the problem as a pastor, that if I turned up the temperature enough to touch the fat cats in the congregation, it just about killed the poor little widows who are already giving more than they should. See?
Yeah.
So you have to do the best you can and leave it with the Lord to impress hearts, but that doesn't relieve us as a responsibility of trying to read the audience.
And I'm not sure which is worse, to have no urgency or have too much.
I think the answer to that is yes. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for talking to us about urgency and Zephaniah. I'd also like to thank Chad Ofterhauer, our program engineer. And for those of you who are listening in, we want to thank you for the good word. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.